I feel like in many ways, the creative process itself is mirroring Jane's own quest. Because it's like you're searching for something that you know is there because you feel it, and you also have some kind of vague memory of it. You don't know exactly how to get there or what it will be like once you're there or if you'll be able to leave. And it's a lot of following your instincts against all odds.
Today we're talking with Jordan Plotner, who's the guy behind this. Jordan composed the entire music for Crypto Z, and what you just heard is the main theme, with the Tuvan throat singing genius as Drew Sierra. Jordan is a British and American award-winning film composer. He's worked on more than 50 films and TV shows and commercials. He's performed on stage in New York, Beijing. He's even wrote and composed his own opera, which premiered at Yale in 2014. And he's worked with giants of the like of Marco Beltrami. And if that name doesn't ring a bell, just think of it as the music composer behind A Quiet Place, Logan, World War Z, and a ton of other blockbusters. Anyway, this is a big dive in music and creativity. Of course, I wanted to talk about Crypto Z and the process of making the music, which we've been working on for a year now. But I also wanted to ask Jordan a little bit how he manages and handles the Sisyphean process of collaborating and creating music for film. I really hope that you'll find this both demystifying and inspiring. And next week we'll meet with Holly Smith and give you an update on the second half of the season, which is coming nicely, even though there's still work to do. And in the meantime, thank you again for your patience and your continued support. And now, onto the art of music composing for film and audio drama with Jordan Plotner. Hey Jordan, so I always wanted to ask you, do you come from a family of musician and composers?
So that's a good question. I am not, but I'm coming from a family of kind of half freelance artists and half like lawyers, doctors, bankers sort of situation. And so it's like half of us followed our parents' advice, and half were like, we're going to do our own thing. And so my mom's a photographer. My grandpa, who is exactly 70 years older than I am to date, so he just turned 96. He's been painting. He's had a kind of 83 plus year career as a painter. And I learned that for three generations before him, there were kind of failed artists in my family that wanted to be, I think it was all visual artists, so they're all painters. They all wanted to be painters, but whether it was the Franco-Prussian War or just general looting and pillaging of the shtetl, it didn't end up happening. So my grandpa was the first kind of to actually become an artist, and I feel I'm continuing that tradition.
I see. So you had no one in your life trying to talk to you out of music?
No. It was, I think everyone just kind of like knew that something, that I was going to do something strange for my life from a young age. But my dad, I think it was around my 13th birthday or so, I had a notebook, an empty notebook, and I was playing guitar at the time, but I was not great. Didn't take it very seriously. And I think I was probably frustrated because I'd seen one of those videos on YouTube where it's like 3-year-old can play all of Paganini on the electric guitar. And it's like a little tiny person shredding and just incredible. And I was probably jealous and feeling resentful. And my dad said, you know, there are always going to be people that are better than you. But what you have is your own mind and your own ability to create. And so he really kept kind of encouraging me to express myself in my words and in music. And so that kind of set me on the path of writing all sorts of angsty songs and notebooks, and then realized I couldn't sing, then started composing more just for instruments. And then into the world of film, television, and audio dramas. I'm realizing now that the projects and kind of the decisions I've made along my very short career thus far, those that have been the best and have kind of paid off the most creatively, and even just kind of in terms of leading to other projects, have been those that I've very much kind of honed in and followed my gut and kind of went somewhere inside to find the music as opposed to trying to guess what it should be.
Do you consider yourself as a film composer or a composer or musician? I don't think there's necessarily a difference, except maybe in the creative process, but can you talk a little bit about that and when that specialization came about?
Yeah, and so I think that there's, on one level, there's not really a difference, for me at least, because it's narrative, it's story, it's understanding characters and humans and what people want and kind of how different dynamics and kind of narrative undercurrents play out over the course of whether it's a 20-minute TV episode arc or a two-hour movie. And so kind of in concept, it's all the same. However, there are definitely differences in practice and kind of when it gets down to the nuts and bolts of actually putting pen to paper or finger to mouse to click record in Pro Tools. And so there was definitely a turning point for me. I remember vividly, I grew up in London. And so we were parked outside. It was in eighth grade. We were parked outside the video store. It's a type of a store that I miss, and I absolutely loved video rental stores. Blockbuster. They've always had great smell. Like, I don't really know what it was. It was like maybe popcorn and like some sort of sterilization. I don't know. A great smell. I was chatting with, I think it was my mom, and she had mentioned that a family friend knew someone who did something with music and movies. And I was like, whoa, there are people who do that? And then my dad gave me, around the same time, the soundtrack to Cinema Paradiso by the now late maestro Ennio Morricone. And I used to listen to that album before school every day. And it was like, whoa, what? I've never felt so moved by music before. I've never heard anything this beautiful and this like, lyrical. What is this? And so then that kind of sent me into the spaghetti western rabbit hole.
Was that before or after seeing the movie?
Before. So I only years later did I actually end up seeing the movie, and it's now my favorite movie. And I've seen it a bunch since then. I actually just watched it the other day after hearing of his passing, and kind of it's one of the most, I think it's still one of the greatest movies ever made and one of the greatest scores. And how it works on its own, number one, just kind of beautiful music, but also its interplay with the themes and the ideas of memory and family and coming home.
It's interesting that you fell in love with that soundtrack without seeing the movie, as the music was standing on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting concept as well, I think, for film. Is like, is, you know, it's a music with a purpose. It's a music to serve a story and a vision, whatever you want to call it. And so it's interesting when it sort of takes life of its own and can stand on its two feet, even outside of it.
Yeah, and especially with that score in particular, there's and kind of the way that he wrote those themes is they're so poignant and evocative and so And I was only kind of creating an idea of the plot of the movie from looking at the song titles, which I guess would have been translations of the cue or of the original Italian, and trying to figure out what was going on with the different characters. And because they're kind of like, they're a continuation of this opera, like this Wagnerian leitmotif concept, and saw it a lot in, or heard it a lot with Lord of the Rings and Howard Shore, and it's huge. And John Williams is kind of the maestro, living maestro today, of these, and just with, I mean, Star Wars or E.T., Jurassic Park, anything. It's Jaws,
the
I guess.
I think the third dimension. I think Indiana Jones.
Like, it's not just beautiful music and beautiful melodies. It's they tell a story themselves. And I think I draw, kind of one of the greatest inspirations that I draw from Morricone and also John Williams is not just their, what they're saying or what they're saying with their music, but what they're not saying, and kind of what they're choosing to hone in on in a particular scene. And actually another director that I've learned, not firsthand, I wish it was firsthand, I've learned this from him, but Martin Scorsese, with his use of music is truly, it's fantastic. And there's a scene in, I think it was Mean Streets, where there was some sort of brawl that was unfolding mm-hmm. in a bar, or it was like a pool hall or something, but there's a great kind of, I'm guessing it would have been more of like a period pop piece. So it was kind of like surf rock, doo-wop-y. And so watching that, you know that you're not scoring the action. It's not some sort of like Avengers 3, like that just wouldn't make sense there. It would just feel out of place. But by choosing to focus in on the comedy, it's not quite the comedy of it, but it's like the inevitability of it. It's like the inevitability of pop music, the inevitability of the song to keep going as you expect it to keep going. So you know that this scene is not going to end and we're all going to be shocked. It's just going to continue on. And it's this way of kind of providing a subtext or almost this counterpoint to the narrative that's unfolding on screen, or I guess in the case of Crypto Zed, in our ears.
I know you work on films, you also do commercials, you do Crypto Z. And I'm wondering if there is a process in which you approach your projects and what you look out for, what do you need in order to get started, and what are you looking for to grab on to kind of get started?
Yeah, so usually I want to be moved. And I want to feel something, and I want to have an attachment to characters or to a story or to a world such that I don't want to leave. I want to keep hanging out with these characters and see what they do and where they go and what they find. And again, it's why like I was very much always been drawn to adventure stories and stories in which people need to unlock these mysteries, and kind of there's the mystery without within themselves, but then there's also without, in the sense of like external mysteries that they need to uncover, like Indiana Jones. I want to be drawn into a narrative is in simplest terms, and for different projects there's a difference in obviously collaboration due to the difference in collaborator. Every process is going to be slightly different. Mm-hmm. Or more than slightly different. But I guess the main things that I want to focus on when I start a project and I'm speaking with the director or producer or creator who's responsible is to kind of iron out and almost like a sonic palette. And it doesn't necessarily need to be in musical terms. It doesn't need to be with other pieces of music, but just kind of almost, it's very much conceptual discussion. And I will always remember our Crypto Z discussions early on and trying to figure out this world. And it's kind of like we're out there at night looking with a flashlight and it's dark and it's foggy and we're trying to figure out like, what is this world? Where are we going? What does it look like? And it's
right. Because people realize you came on super early in the process, or pretty early.
Yeah.
Pretty much at the same time, maybe, that we were recording the actors, yeah. Or even before then. I don't know. Basically, all we had is scripts.
Yeah. And so I think that one of the things there is just, and I love coming in the process of just the script phase, because for a number of reasons. One, it shows that the director or writer or creator is proud of their scripts and that they're confident that the music should be rooted in the narrative and in the story rather than just in the kind of the beats on screen.
Right.
And I say beats, like, or I guess just like the different moments on screens, like the different hit points that you got to sync up action to. And so with Crypto Z, it was, and we talked about in our earlier discussions, this idea of leitmotifs and creating themes for these characters. And that was kind of the, probably the first maybe 4 months or so, 5 months of our collaboration in the creative process for Crypto Z was coming up with themes.
Right, but the idea was to kind of like build, and it's still the idea now, to build things for each character that would be able to come back and be developed as the character with the character's journey, and then also maybe a main Iceman theme for our creature, which we found later on.
Yeah, and that was very much a process of, I mean, you're always hard on yourself in saying that you're not a good musical communicator, which I always disagree about, because yes, you might not have musical theory terms, but one does not need to be a clear communicator. One does not need to know music theory to be a clear musical communicator. And I think it's just about knowing kind of what you want, and it's emotion. It's speaking in energy and what you want to feel, and kind of the pull and the almost the momentum of your emotions. And I think I enjoyed the way that you described things, and the way that you kind of laid out the story for me and the world and the characters. And I found that was inspiring to write to.
First of all, thank you. I'm going to channel a little bit common director's fear, which is leading your collaborators, your creative collaborators into a possible dead end, or into a place where you realize you got lost and this isn't where you want to be.
Yeah, and so, and I mean, there's obviously everyone wants to get it right the first time, but that usually doesn't happen. And I remember the first short film I ever worked on. It was the first like LA short film I ever worked on. And it was before I started college. I was taking a gap year and I was in LA for a few months, and I was an assistant, and my boss had gotten this project and he kind of handed it off to me, and I was scoring the film, and I remember I did a first pass, and the email back was like, I think we're going to go, let's give this another shot. And let's go in a little bit more in this direction. What I had written was too emotional, I think. I don't remember exactly, but I remember being so crushed that they hadn't liked my music and that it didn't work, right, and that I would have to just scrap it, and being like, what? Like that, man, just feeling so down about it. And I mean, now years later, I laugh because you learn to kill your darlings, but like, I expect a new direction more than I expect a yes. Maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, mm-hmm. but they're like, I've basically had to get used to it. And also understanding that it doesn't mean that they don't like you as a person, or they don't like your music as
exactly
a style. It's just that wasn't working. There's a leap of faith that every collaborator needs to take, and anyone needs to take when starting on a new project. And I think from a composer's perspective, there's a leap of faith of trust that one needs to place in the director, or the creator, or whoever the visionary for the project is, and the collaborator. There's the leap of faith is to trust that where you end up is better than where you would have started on your own. And knowing that with this back and forth, even though it might be tedious, even though you might get an email that says like, no, this isn't working, while you're sitting on the couch and really hungry but haven't had dinner yet, so you're kind of grumpy and it just hits you and it's just the wrong feeling. Like, you got to know that those moments might happen, but it's for the greater good of the project. And having that faith is I find, very important in any sort of project and partnership and collaboration, and knowing that, yeah, there can be ups and downs, but the project is going to be somewhere different and just beyond what could have happened without that, if that makes sense.
Right. That, and you can only bring the horse to the river.
Yeah.
You have to accept that, first of all, the feedbacks are not personal.
Yeah.
It's very hard to criticize yourself, and we need feedbacks to self-reflect. And it's always, even when it's negative, it's always, you know, to be taken as a generous thing. Yeah. You're not going to change the director, or you're not going to change the vision of the project, or you're not going to stir in this direction, even if you're Mozart. And if they don't know, they don't realize that they're working with Mozart, like, there's nothing Mozart can do, you know, besides wait for the next director or wait for the next client or wait for the next project, right?
No, it's true. It's true.
So what can you do as a music composer to kind of manage expectation, to manage disagreements or creative tension with the director?
The composer is hired not to be a star. Like, it is not going to be Crypto Z starring Jordan Plotner, because number one, no one wants that.
Right.
The project doesn't want that. I don't want that. And like, it's uncomfortable for everyone. And so I'm coming on board to give it like a little push from below almost. It's kind of like controlling, not that I know how to sail, but I imagine like operating a sailboat, you need to like learn how to leverage the wind in order to move in a certain direction. And I think that there is an element of that with kind of harnessing one's own pride and ego, whereas you need to have enough faith in yourself to know that the music that you're writing is going to turn out to be something. Because, again, in the actual compositional process, like it could end up with hundreds of tracks for like one particular cue. And I could be just starting with the first track, and like I don't know how it's all going to sound at the end. I mean, I have some sort of idea, but I need to, just because I have the idea doesn't mean it's suddenly poof, it's existence.
So just exactly on that subject, how did you start going about composing for, because you were going to talk about the instrument that you got for at the
with
beginning.
Crypto Z, I got a, like right in the beginning, I got a little semi-modular synthesizer, like portable synthesizer, and I was going to be traveling a bit, so I wanted to be able to work on the road. And I say on the road, that sounds far more exciting than it was. It was more likely going to be in like hospital or like a doctor waiting rooms. So it was going to be me tootling away on my synthesizer. And it was kind of a learning process because I'd never operated one of these before, and kind of learning how to tame the beast. And I just did, I sent all sorts of themes. I would just record, because there's no record button on the synthesizer. Like it's an analog synthesizer. And so it was just like, I recorded into my computer just for like a line, then went through and edited and chopped up into little themes and then sent them all over. And I think the initial response was that we needed to go in a new direction. But we ended up using a bunch of them actually, and they've proven to be very helpful and useful. And I think that, especially in the caves, a lot of that synthesizer stuff, and also, in the beginning with kind of when Jane is talking about the Iceman, some of that synthesizer appears. I think for the most part, maybe except with the exception of one or two characters, we had worked out the themes for all of the main characters. And so there is the kind of the Jane, it's kind of almost the memory theme. There's like the childhood theme, mm-hmm. but there was also the like the Iceman love theme. But then there was also the kind of mm-hmm. adventure theme. But then there's another one is rooted in a monastery. I was like, okay, I need to make myself sound like a monk today. I need to listen to a lot of Gregorian chants. Luckily, I had gone through a phase in high school where I was really into Gregorian chants. And so I then spent the day or the afternoon or something just recording myself, just trying to channel my inner monk from all around my studio. And it was a great time.
So we were looking for this like thematic thing that represented the Iceman, but also represented the series. It was just a very hard thing to articulate. I can't even remember how
I don't either.
I sent you on that road.
I think we've struggled to try and say something.
Yeah, and then the throat singing came about. And I can't remember whose idea it was. At this point, it probably doesn't matter.
This is probably my favorite piece that I've done still in the show. Just because it's crazy. And I felt like a crazy person working on it. And which is oftentimes the greatest experience. So it started off the theme. I was stuck on it. I didn't know what to do. I had sent over a few things, but they weren't quite right. I think some of the things we ended up using for other themes. So they worked for something, but not quite for this. And this is one of those rare exceptions where the music came to me in my sleep, which is a great time. I love when that happens. Not often, never know. But I woke up and kind of like whistled a melody into like a voice memo. It was kind of the two main bits. It was the harmonics, which is like the guitar. That thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cello melody on top. But it's kind of like me half asleep, like, and like trying to make sense of it afterwards. Great. But then it kind of went from there. And what I was trying to convey in that theme was this element of yearning. And it's like this melody that's climbing up, but it doesn't know when it's reached the top and it's still waiting. And it knows that there's something immense on the other side, but it doesn't know what. And it's this adventure that is like, do we know if it's fulfilled? I don't know. And so there's this, I think that yearning quality was something we wanted. And so the other element was the Iceman. And so if one were walking by my studio and was looking in, they'd be like, what is this person doing? Because I probably did 30 or 40 takes standing all over the place, like grunting and yelling to try and like make the Iceman chants. And there are things like oh, yeah, and just like all of these things that I just like, what, where is this coming from? And just piled them on top of each other and ended up sounding like an army of Icemen. But we couldn't stop there because we needed a Tuvan throat singer, which is it's an instrument in one's throat, let's say. It's these singers that are able to sing basically multiple notes at once by changing the harmonic and the overtones, and they're basically playing the overtones in their throat. It's a very cool thing. I had seen it on there was a recording session or a project I had helped out on, Azdrew Sierra, probably one of the few Grammy-winning, I think it's the Grammy-winning Tuvan singer, and he also just like a really cool guy. And so I knew that I wanted to work with him at some point, and I was like, this is it. This is going to be the project. And so I reach out to him and he's game, and he comes by my studio, and nothing could prepare me for the sheer force of the throat singer, because it was like after every take he would sing, and I would be like, are you okay? I would want to, like, can I get you anything? Because it just sounded so painful and violent. And it was just an extraordinary sound that I'd never been so close to. And it was one of the coolest sessions of my life. And I'm sorry that you couldn't join me on that. I know you're still bitter about that. I apologize.
It was like, yeah. It was like one of those things that there's like a few things that I really look forward to doing in CryptoZ, and like that was one of them, but it's fine.
But the thing is, season two.
Exactly.
Right?
I'm not giving up.
Hopefully we'll have, when we start doing concerts with live concerts of CryptoZ music, when it's that big, then
Right.
There'll be some crazy performances. And so we kind of mixed those all in together, and that's how we ended up with this, the theme.
Right. Because, I mean, behind the throat singing, like, what we needed is exactly what you described, like, something that is kind of a force of nature that's kind of almost super, superhuman, and that commands authority, that commands nature, that it was just a perfect sound. And, you know, so distinct and so different from every other characters. Because we've been trying to find associate instruments to some characters. Because there is the melody and the music, but there's also the you know, the texture of the instruments that we've been, that took us, you know, quite a bit of back and forth to kind of figure out.
Yeah. So oftentimes, I find the need to take a more conceptual or intellectual approach to it. So an example would be like for the monks, like that the decision to do a Gregorian chant is, I'd say it's like an intellectual decision because it fits conceptually. But sometimes for the Iceman or the kind of the main theme, that was not the sort of thing where I was thinking out and planning. It was just kind of something that hit, that was like very much hit me. And one of my kind of go-to secret weapons is I have a clothes hanger, but not dress clothes. I went to the hardware store, got all sorts of like sheet metal and pipes and tubes and also my mom's dish rack I took. Sorry, Mom. And if I wait, let me see if I can throw something at it so you can hear it from a distance. I don't know if that that could be heard. I mean, it's like a lovely, it's kind of like if I had a pet parrot that would just like call back to me sometimes and just mimic me. It's like, this is sometimes just kind of speaks, and it's just like with its metal song. I sound like a crazy person now, I realize. But I have a bunch of like cello and violin bows. And then I would kind of bow on these pipes or this metal and do kind of different bowing effects and like some sort of tremolos and get cool slidey textures. Like the cello is kind of like the voice, Jane's voice almost. We wanted it to be this deeply feeling, inspired, yearning voice. And I'm not much of a cellist, but I gave it a shot. It took me a lot of takes to get this right in feeling that it was kind of, even in its confident moments, it was still fragile. I feel like in many ways, the creative process itself is mirroring Jane's own quest. Because it's like you're searching for something that you know is there because you feel it, and you also have some kind of vague memory of it. You don't know exactly how to get there or what it will be like once you're there or if you'll be able to leave, but it's this, and it's a lot of following your instincts against all odds and kind of pushing through obstacles, whatever they might be. It could be Feist, they could be COVID, it could be any number of things. Feist and COVID, the global extinction, the mass
cold
extinction.
I think there was also
things.
Like a Yeah, and there was also the cold and the ice. The elements were, I remember, were part of the conversation as well.
We wanted it to be very icy, and I think that's one of the things, even though it's just about ice as a material, and as just a state, it's strong because it's solid, but it's still very fragile. This balancing of, again, conviction and strength and confidence with fragility and vulnerability and understanding that you don't know what lies ahead.
Right. I think there's a specificity to Audiodrama and Cryptozy, at least for me, in terms of music. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just my imagination. But the fact that we don't have an image, there is so much more that is left to the imagination. And I'm curious if something of a different process for you.
Yeah, definitely. And one element about it that I love And it's one thing I wish that there was more of in film is kind of the overtures, where you have a moment, like I'm thinking of Lawrence of Arabia is the first one that pops into my head, where you have just these beautiful, beautiful pieces of music over like a black screen or something very still going on. And it's asking of you, okay, take this moment. It's like, it's kind of the movie theater announcement, like silence your cell phones. This is now the film itself saying, deep breath, enter our world. And you need to actively be using your imagination in this world. You can sit back and get struck by it, but there's also that level of, if you engage, there's a whole new, it's like you've found a secret oasis of riches and of material and enjoyment in the story. And I think with audio dramas, and with Crypto Z in particular, it's kind of that overture type concept where the listener is going to be actively participating and using their, his or her, or their own imagination in this world. And so I enjoy you as listeners because you're committing to the story in a way that's like you're accepting a responsibility to build the picture of the world yourself. And it's asking a lot. And we're trying to give you everything that we can in to help you create that world in your own mind. But we can only cover, or in this case, we're only covering one sense. And I think that it's an exciting thing because everyone's Crypto Z experience will be different because it's in their own mind. The visual aspects are in their own mind. With an audio drama, you are immersing yourself.
Well, on that note, I can't think of a better ending for this episode, though. Thank you very much, Jordan, for taking the time. And thank you guys for your patience. I know I'm starting to get some hate mail for not releasing new episodes, and it was a decision we made to release the episodes early after the pandemic started. And I admit this is a bit longer than I expected, so please be patient with us. In the meantime, thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for sharing this episode with a friend, and I hope to see you next week. Thank you so much.